You probably already figured out that I'm not Josh, but I may be the next best thing. I'm his father-in-law. He married my daughter, so he has the same love in common there. But he's in Valdosta, and he asked me to fill in for him today. But I said, I'm already teaching a class down the hall. He said, well, you can go ahead and teach your material if you'll occupy the space and take care of my class for me. So we're throwing you a little bit of a curve, especially those members of my class that are expecting me to be in a small group and setting where they can have a lot of class discussion, and I always ask them a lot of questions. In the auditorium class format, we can't really do that as well. I can't hear you very well. I've got a hearing aid that I lost that doesn't work because I don't have it anymore. And sometimes you can't hear each other when you make comments, so it's very difficult. I encourage you to try anyway. I love to have interaction with the class. That's why I prefer teaching a small class, but we'll do the best we can to get through an auditorium setting. And I wanted to at least kind of bring up the 50 of you that have never been in the class up to date a little bit about what we've been doing the last 5 or 6 weeks. So I gave you the entire class outline. If you haven't picked one up, they're on the podium back there in the back. If you want to get one now, if you don't have one, or later on. But we started out with the idea of having the faith of Abraham. So first thing you have to do is you have to define your terms. What is faith? And we spent almost a whole class period writing all of the words associated with faith on the blackboard. And all of those are really not adequate in defining faith. Even if you go to Hebrews 11, even if you go to the passage in James that describes faith without works is dead, all those things are not quite describing what the faith of Abraham is. Because when you look at the word that's translated faith, it's found 450 times in the Bible. 250 times of those, it's translated faith, but 200 of them, it's translated belief. And the lexicons that all those people that define words out of Greek and everything like that say, a better word in English would be the word trust. So if you run that through your mind just a little bit, even in the songs that we sing, instead of trust and obey, would it do any violence to the context of that song to say believe and obey, or have faith and obey? All kind of interchangeable when you're talking about the generic kind of faith, belief, and trust. But the faith of Abraham is much more specific and much more of a narrow definition of faith. And the best I could come up with, and it's probably far inadequate in describing it, would be that the faith of Abraham is trusting God's promises, trusting that he will do what he says he will do, in spite of, or that goes beyond, your own human understanding. It's just something that you can't normally believe is going to happen. And the examples that we have, and we'll get to some of those eventually, how could he believe that he would have a child at his age and Sarah would have a child at his age? It's beyond human understanding that that would happen. How would he believe that he would be the father of all those nations? It's beyond human understanding. Even the things that we believe and hold very, very cherished about our own belief system, you know, the inspiration of the Bible. Doesn't that go a little bit beyond the normal reasoning processes to think that, what was it, 50 different men over a period of 1,500 years all wrote part of the Bible, and it doesn't conflict none of it conflicts? Doesn't that require a little bit more than just normal belief to believe that? The virgin birth, doesn't that suspend belief to do that? The creation. How did God make something out of nothing? That's the kind of belief, that's the kind of faith that we want to have. And the third part, defining faith, defining the faith of Abraham, and then figuring out how do we get that? Having the faith of Abraham, name of the course. In the course of the first few weeks that we met, we talked about answering those questions. Is that increased faith a matter of more quantity, more faith, or quality? Is it the quality of faith that you have, or the quantity of faith? Or is it both? We wrestled with that for a little while. We talked about, is it easier to trust in God or trust in obeying God? Well, if we're on a system of works where our obedience is what makes us faithful, Jesus condemned such as that. They came to him, didn't we do all these things in your name? Didn't we do that? He says, depart from me, I never knew you. So if your system of Christianity is based on works and not faith, you missed the boat. You didn't get it. You didn't get it right. So we think about that. And does this excessive degree of faith that Abraham had, does that immediately come when you become a Christian and gives you a silver bullet against sin? No, it doesn't. In fact, the opposite may be true, that the attacks of the devil may be increased now that he's lost you and you've become a Christian. He may have ramped up the attacks on you, trying to get you back in his fold. So you don't have an automatic, a better chance at not sinning simply because you have faith and simply because you have the level of faith that caused you to become a Christian. So those are some of the things that we talked about. Abraham is a model of faith, and he's also a model of obedience. He obeyed what he was supposed to do. He's mentioned 70 times in the New Testament. And we're just about ready. Maybe we'll finish today, maybe next time we meet, which is week after in our little class, finishing up with the Old Testament, and then we're really going to get into how do we obtain that faith in the context of New Testament information that we'll go over. But we talk about Abraham being mentioned 70 times, and then we talk about, and this was last week and the week before, we talked about, did Abraham have some lapses of faith? Of course he did. He's human. And one of those big lapses was when he told Sarah, tell everybody you're my brother and not my husband, and it'll save my life. Now, what promise of God did he say he's not going to be able to take care of this, so I have to take care of it myself? What kind of promise did he say God can't do when he relies on his own initiative of saying, even though you're a 65-year-old woman, you still are a knockout. You're better than Elizabeth Taylor was at 65. You're good looking, and they're going to kill me so they can have you as their wife if you don't lie to them and tell them that you're my brother. Yeah? So, brother, yeah. Brother and wife both. Yeah, I got that tangled up. So, he lapsed there, and he not only did it once, but he did it twice in the context of the Old Testament. Once when he was in Egypt, they had a famine. He went to Egypt. And while he was down there, lied to the Pharaoh. And then we figured at least 10 years later and maybe 25 years. We don't have a real good date on the second time when he lied to the king Abimelech of Gerar, which is in the Philistine region of Palestine, lied to him and did the same thing. Now, what God did in these settings, and it's very interesting how that what was meant for bad turned out good. Because in Egypt, the Pharaoh gave him all kinds of stuff, you know. And he took that stuff with him when he left Egypt. One of those things that he took was a handmaid, because they gave him a bunch of servants, and that's probably where they got Hagar, who became the mother of Ishmael some 20 years later. But when he left Abimelech gave him 10,000 pieces of silver. Now, we didn't know exactly what the exchange rate for pieces of silver was, but we estimated that somewhere between $100,000 and $1 million worth of money. Buy you off. You know, sorry that we took your wife. Maybe this makes amends for it. Take all these animals too, and servants, you know, and live anywhere you want to. We don't want to get your God on the bad side of us, so we're going to be nice to you, Abraham. So he got a great deal of wealth from those two kings, King Pharaoh and King Abimelech, because of what he did that was evil, really. It was wrong for him to have Sarah lie. So we get on down and we talk about the different ways of describing this level of faith. And several times in both Old and New Testament, it's described as the faith that is reckoned as righteousness or imputed as righteousness or accounted for as righteousness. It's not the same as righteousness because it's not righteousness, but God looks at it as the same as righteousness. This level of faith that we were striving to have, that Abraham had, is called imputed or counted for as righteousness. So that's our goal, is to try to get to that. And as we read through the scriptures, and I gave you all those, if you want to look those up, of course, next week we'll have Sam Jones in here. The following week, if you want to follow through with the last three sessions of our class, we're more than glad to have you join us in room two back there. But that's where we'll finish this. So what we don't get today, we've only got 3 weeks to finish. But I wanted to call your attention to Genesis 13, 14 through 18 in our lesson there. That's how far we got in the 5 or 6 weeks that we've had the class already. But in Genesis 13, 14, "And the Lord said to Abraham, after Lot had separated from him, 'Lift your eyes now and look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, and westward, for all the land which you see I give to you and your descendants forever. And I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if a man could number the dust of the earth, then your descendants also could be numbered. Arise, walk in the land through its length and its breadth, for I give it to you.' Then Abraham moved his tent and went and dwelt in the by the terebinth trees of Mamre, which are in Hebron, and built an altar there to the Lord." So he's going to hang out for a while now in Hebron, which is south of Jerusalem, down in kind of in that region, you know, between the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean Ocean. A lot of that was controlled at that time by the Philistines. But this is the promise that God gives Abraham. And it may be the first time that he's made this promise, and we wanted to make it important that this is part of the deal. And then we're going to, in a minute, we're going to come to the covenant that he has. But before we do that, we want to take a look at Genesis 15, 2 through 6. But Abram said, "Lord God, what will you give me, seeing I go childless, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus?" Then Abram said, "Look, you have given me no offspring. Indeed, one born in my house is my heir." And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, "This one shall not be your heir, but one who will come from your own body shall be your heir." Then he brought him outside and said, "Look now toward heaven and count the stars, if you're able to number them." And he said to him, "So shall your descendants be." And he believed in the Lord, and he accounted it to him for righteousness. So he's saying, since I'm 75, 85, 90, we don't have a date stamp on this. I'm that old, I don't have a child yet. Sarah's too old to have kids. Since I don't have one, then the normal thing, and the culture allowed that. When you study the culture of these Canaanite, and as well as the people from the Babylonian countries of the Chaldeans and Persians, if you didn't have an heir, you could designate one of your slaves, one of your servants, who had been born in your household to be your heir. And he says, "Here's Eliezer, you know. We got him way back when I lived in Haran, Padan Aram area. You know, that's not too far from Damascus. That's probably when they picked him up as a servant, got him in the household, at least his parents or whatever. And he was born in the household. So it's a logical, he's maybe the chief servant at this point. You know, the guy that's been with them the longest. Can't he be my heir? What's God say? Nope, he's not going to be your heir. He's going to be somebody from your own genealogy, from your own genes. Your own DNA is going to be the heir. He's not going to be it." And he said, "I'll tell you again. Told you before, to a couple of chapters before. I'll tell you again. All of this land is going to be yours, and you're going to have a lot of descendants." And Abraham believed it. Now, is it easy for you to believe that kind of a wild story? Not very easy. But it's that level of faith that Abraham had. And the last verse there said, "And it was accounted to him," depending on your translation, I've got New King James, "accounted to him for righteousness," to believe this story, that he would have that many descendants and have that kind of land. Okay, the next one, we have another substitute. That's in Genesis 16, 1 through 3. Now we get Sarah into the picture. Now Sarah, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. So Sarah said to Abraham, "See now, the Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Please go into my maid. Perhaps I shall obtain children by her." And Abraham heeded the voice of Sarah. Then Sarah, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and gave her to her husband Abraham to be his wife after Abraham had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan. Got kind of a date stamp on this. He's been in the land of Canaan, left Haran, moved down there, been there 10 years now. And we know that he was 75 when he left. So he's 85 at this particular time, and Sarah is 75 because she's 10 years younger. Said, I can't have children at 75 years old. So the way we solve this problem is you just have some children by my handmaid. Now, do we know of any other time in history where handmaids come in handy to have some additional children? Yeah. Do you know anybody by the name of Rachel and Leah and Bildad and what was the other one named? Hadad or Bildad, something, whatever they were the handmaids of those two wives. And there were 12 boys and a girl born between all four of those that became the tribes of Israel, the children of Jacob. You know, Joseph being one of those, and he being the double portion, got Manasseh and Ephraim is his two tribes. So there was that whole story unfolds, but those were handmaids. So it was a common thing. We're going to find out as we study through this that Abraham had another wife after Sarah died, and he had a whole bunch more kids, even at 100 and whatever that was. So it's not uncommon to have more than one wife in that culture. Did God approve of that? Were they Christians? Did they understand the laws of marriage and divorce and all that kind of stuff? No, they were pagan people called out by God in the patriarchal period and to do his will. Okay, now we get to chapter 17, and this is all totally new material now for my class. And we're going to study the elements of the covenant that God has with Abraham. This is a deal. And you do your part of the deal, and I'll do my part of the deal. So it's not a unilateral thing here. It's a quid pro quo. Is that the legal term for it? That you do your part, I'll do my part. And let's see what the first element of that covenant is. Beginning in Genesis 17, when Abraham was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I am Almighty God, walk before me and be blameless. And I will make covenant between me and you and will multiply you exceedingly. And Abram fell on his face and God talked to him saying, as for me, behold, my covenant is with you and you shall be a father of many nations. So the first thing that we have in this covenant is that Abraham will be the father of many nations. Then the second thing we have is your name will no longer be called Abram, but your name will be called Abraham, for I've made you a father of many nations. Well, actually, that's still part of the first one. I will make you exceedingly fruitful and will make nations of you, and kings shall come from you. Then he starts the second one, verse 8 there. I'm skipping around here. Also, I will give you and your descendants after you the land in which you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan as an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. So the second thing is the land promise. Give you the land. And to me it was very interesting there that he ended that by saying, and I will be their God. Now, what kind of gods did the land of Canaan have? They had pagan gods, all kinds of pagan gods. So he says that when it becomes your land, those people will look to me as their God. So there's more to it than just the land promise, but it's a territorial promise as well. Verse 9 through 14, we have the third item. And God said to Abraham, As for you, you shall keep my covenant, you and your descendants after you throughout their generations. This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your descendants after you. Every male child among you shall be circumcised, and you shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskins, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and you. He who is 8 days old among you shall be circumcised, every male child in your generation. He who is born in your house or bought with money from any stranger who is not your descendant. He who is born in your house and who is bought with your money must be circumcised, and my covenant shall be in your flesh for an everlasting covenant. And the uncircumcised male child who is not circumcised in the flesh and a foreskin, that person shall be cut off from his people. He has broken my covenant. So that's the part that Abraham has to do. God's going to make him a nation of many people, going to have many descendants. He's going to give him this land. In return, Abraham has to be circumcised, and everybody else in his household and all of his children, and from there on, the descendants of Abraham are supposed to be circumcised. Okay, the next element begins 15 and 16. We've got a name change for Sarah. Then God said to Abraham, as for Sarah your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. And I will bless her and also give you a son by her when I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of peoples shall be from her. So he's being rather specific now that she will bear a child. Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said in his heart, shall a child be born of a man who is 100 years old? And Sarah, who is 90 years old, bare a child. And Abraham said to God, oh, that Ishmael might live before you. So he wants to substitute Ishmael instead of this unknown, hypothetical at his point, so unbelievable that he even laughs about it. You think that's an act of a faithful man to laugh at God, to laugh at his promises? Is it a lapse of his faith to laugh? And yet he's called the most faithful man. So even the most faithful people can have lapses. Yes, sir?
I think it shows that his faith still needs to grow.
Still needs to grow some more. Quantity or quality?
Both.
Both. Okay. All right.
Jim. Because he's so happy.
Well, yeah, I guess you can laugh when you're happy. But that's not the kind of laugh that Sarah has the next chapter, because she gets into the laughing business too. And she not only compounds the laughing about it, but she lies about having laughed as we get into that passage. Okay, now, the name change, the laughter, the fifth item that I noticed is in verse 19, that Sarah will bear the child, and his name is going to be Isaac. I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant and with his descendants after him. So the promise not only is for Abraham, but it's for this invisible, call him invisible because it's an act of faith. Faith is what you don't see. If you could see it, it wouldn't be faith. Even has a name.
Yeah.
Yes.
The important thing too is Isaac's name stands for he laughs.
Yes, yes. He laughs.
So, uh-huh. God, I think that's a
little bit of humor. From God, yeah. All right, as for Ishmael, I have heard you. Behold, I bless him, and he'll be fruitful. We'll multiply exceedingly. He will have, he'll beget 12 princes, and I will make him a great nation. So there's something in it for Ishmael as well. And then after laughing and getting his act back together and getting back, then he does perform his part of the deal in Genesis 17:23-27. So Abraham took Ishmael his son, all who were born in his house, and all who were bought by with his money, every male among the men of Abraham's house, and circumcised the flesh of the foreskins that very same day as God had said to him. Abraham was 99 years old when he was circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin. And Ishmael his son was 13 years old when he was circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin. Now, why is this a faithful act? Does it make any sense to your reasonable mind that this guy, this little surgical procedure would have anything to do with receiving land promise, receiving the promise all the way back to the promise that his seed would be all the things that it would be.
Yeah. It could be like a rancher brands his cattle, so that he knows that those are his possession.
Right. But is that illogical for us to think that that would make any difference as to why the promise would be kept? So it requires a little bit more faith than just saying, I believe. When we think about that level of faith, don't we experience that same kind of thing in the plan of salvation? Now, we can find people in America, all over the place, that will say, I believe in Jesus, I believe in God. But their actions don't necessarily follow through on that. So it's not an unreasonable thing for us to say that belief is necessary for salvation. That doesn't be a problem at all. And even to confess that you believe in God and believe in Christ doesn't require a whole lot of faith, maybe a little bit, maybe the level that the devils had. They believed and trembled. And even to repent, it's logical that if you've been a bad guy, and we all have been, that you try to do better now that you're a Christian. Does that require a whole bunch of faith? But for us to do something to complete that step, that final step of being baptized, does our logical mind say that would have anything to do with our salvation? No. It requires a degree of faith that is accounted for as righteousness for us to submit to that baptism, because it doesn't make sense in our logical mind. Yes? Faith without works is dead. When I'm teaching that step in individual Bible study, I always go to Naaman, the leper, from the officer from Syria, who came down and the prophet said, go dip in the Jordan River 7 times. He said, that's foolish. I'm not going to do that. We got clean water up where I came from, you dirty old Jordan River. How's that going to make my leprosy well? And the little servant girl said, if he'd ask you to climb Mount Everest or pay him a ransom of $1 million, whatever, some big thing, you would have done it. But the simple little thing of just obeying what I told you to do will make you well, will cleanse your leprosy. And so he kind of reluctantly, I've dipped 6 times, and I still have the leprosy. I wonder what's going to happen if I go ahead and do this one more time. Probably pretty skeptical about the thing. But he did and became well. Same way with us. If we will submit to what God tells us to do, we can obtain the same kind. Yeah? I think the simplicity of his reasoning is he just did it because he was told to do it. I think the faith was more on the part of the servant girl that said, you know, if he had said something big, you would have done that. I think that's where the true faith was, in my opinion. But I don't know that it's really clearly stated that way. So if you want to have a different opinion, that's fine. Go ahead. Any other questions or comments? Your own understanding is going to get you in trouble. God was wired different than we are. Yes? Right. Yep. Very good. Any more? I love to have comments from the group. Okay. Now we have the next item in our list of scriptures is Genesis 18, 9 through 15. We have already mentioned that Sarah laughed also when she heard, they overheard the conversation. And then when she was confronted, she said, "No, I didn't laugh. That wasn't me. I didn't laugh." So she had a pretty big lapse there, not only of laughing, that she would become a mother at 89 years old, probably turned 90 before the child was born, and then lying about having laughed. Then in Genesis 22, we start, and we may not be able to finish that, but I had hoped to be able to finish Genesis 22 this morning so that we could get more into the New Testament and getting into having this faith that is accounted for righteousness in our own application. But Genesis 22 is the offering of Isaac. And if we had the time, I would want to stop at each little ending of a phrase and say, did this show some level of faith? We may not have the time to do that this morning, but let's take a look at Genesis chapter 22. Now, it came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, "Abraham," and he said, "Here I am." And he said, "Take now your son, your only son, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you." Now, is that kind of a shocking request, wouldn't you think? Kind of surprising. And Moriah is 3 days' journey. Now, the traditional site of Moriah, and nobody knows for sure, it's one of those places that they kind of see it on a map, there'll be a question mark by it. It's somewhere up near Jerusalem. And he's living in Hebron. At least that's the last account we have of where he was. Somewhere down by Bathsheba and Hebron. So it's a 3-day journey, which means it's about, what, 20, 30, 40 miles maybe? Because he's going to have to be carrying lumber with him, the kindling for the fire and things like that it tells us that he did. So they're going to be gone 3 days to get there. So Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him and Isaac his son, and he split the wood before the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. So he didn't mess around. He left early in the morning to start doing this. That's a faithful act. Then on the third day, Abraham lifted his eyes and saw the place afar off. And Abraham said to his young men, "Stay here with the donkey. The lad and I will go yonder and worship, and we will come back to you." Is that a faithful saying to the two of them? Or we're going to go up there, but I'll bring him back? He said, "We will come back," right? Does that sound like he's really going to do what God said and sacrifice the boy there? He had faith. And we would think, this is a bad mistake that Moses made writing that. But we've got Hebrews to explain it. Because in Hebrews, it says that Abraham, believing that God could raise him from the dead, his thought pattern was, I'll have to sacrifice Isaac to fulfill what God told me to do, but he's able to bring him back from the dead. Then we can come back and join our two people. That was his thinking of how that's going to be resolved. God had a different plan.
It also shows how much Abram's faith has grown since
right.
the time.
Right, absolutely. It had grown some since then. That's right. That would be hard to do, too. Now, do you see any similarities in Abraham's sacrifice of his only son that he loved and God's sacrifice of his only son that he loved? So there's some interesting little sidelines here to think about, too. We'll come back. Verse 6. So Abraham took the wood and the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son, and took the fire in his hand and a knife, and the two of them went together. But Isaac spoke to Abraham, his father, and said, My father. And he said, Here am I, son. And he said, Look, the fire, the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? And Abraham said, My son, God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering. And the two of them went together. So, is he lying to his boy there? No. How's he going to get this lamb then? Right. He had complete trust. That's the level that we want to obtain, that complete trust. And we'll get into this in the next 3 weeks when we meet, but are there times in your life that you don't have that complete trust? A crisis point? The author of our little book that I read it three times so I could try to absorb all of his points in there, said that the worst time that we fail as a Christian people is at the death of a loved one. That our total, complete trust in God is likely to falter when we have the death of a loved one. You think about it. Do we really have the complete trust that God's taking care of things when seemingly there's no sense that our child would die? There's no sense that our spouse might have cancer and die, or whatever it might be, that we have that lapse of our own faith, and it requires that level of faith that Abraham had, the complete trust. Another event that we have difficulty in having complete trust is we have been programmed, and most of us can quote the plan of salvation for the alien sinner to have his sins taken away. But how many of us really believe that God will continue to take our sins away after we've become a Christian and when we make sinful acts and need forgiveness of those? We falter there a lot. And those are the tidbits that we'll get into a little more deep when we get back in our little classroom. Thank you for your attention. Anybody that didn't get an outline, we may have a few left.